The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Hemorrhagic fevers and fevers of unknown origin is presented by Dr. Mark Elaine Durie.
So we're going to talk a bit about viral hemorrhagic fevers. I'm going to point out the things that I would, if I were you, that I would know. There's not a whole lot, but the one thing that I would definitely take home is the second section there is hantaviruses. And the reason is that hantaviruses are in the United States, okay? And when I finished my residency program, I went and had to do my public health service, and I went and lived on the Navajo reservation, and I actually saw two cases of hantavirus on the reservation when I was there. I made two diagnoses of hantavirus. So that's something that, again, if I were a writer of the boards, I would want you to know because it's important information because it's here in the U.S. Ebola, obviously, is in West Africa or in Central Africa. And then we're going to spend some time talking about the fevers of unknown origins. And I'll tell you what, it was hard to write that section because there's just so much there. And it's just one of those things where there's so many different places where test writers can get you on. So I'm going to try to parse through that pretty well. This is a long list of viral hemorrhagic fevers and various pathogens. The ones that I would definitively know are Ebola, definitively know hantavirus, which I don't see on there right now. I was looking, I can't believe as I was preparing for this morning, I think it's not on there. I would definitely add hantavirus, but it's going to come up in the section in a moment. And the other one I would recognize is dengue fever as well. Okay, so you should know about dengue fever. Know that we're seeing the climate change, right, we're seeing organisms that are moving from the southern hemisphere are slowly starting to find new niches in the northern hemisphere. And so they're starting to see some cases of dengue in Florida, right, that were not imported cases. So I would definitely know about dengue fever, know about the vaccines, and know how dengue is transmitted. And then, of course, any times that we're thinking about viral hemorrhagic pathogens, we have to consider risk factors, travel to endemic areas, and contact with known cases. And, of course, these specimens for viral culture require what's called a BSL-4 lab, biosafety level 4. So those are the things that you've seen in the movies, or the CDC guys are all dressed in the big spacesuits walking around. You know, those are BSL-4 labs. Definition, difficult to define, but it's mostly fever with some sort of bleeding diatheses. When I was in, if I were to write a board question, when I was in Sierra Leone, the three main symptoms I saw with Ebola over and over again, repeatedly, was profound fatigue. Now think about what's going on. They've got Ebola, right? The most pathogenic and virulent organism known to humans, right? That's a big inflammatory response that's going to happen. And what happens when your inflammatory system is going crazy like that? Huge response. It's going to make you tired, right? Because it's sucking ATP to drive that inflammation engine. So you're not going to... I'm talking profound fatigue that, like, people, like, if a bathroom was right over there, they didn't care. They just would rather just either lay on the floor, lay on the bed, and soil themselves because they just didn't have the energy to walk 5 feet over to the bathroom. So, profound fatigue. Diarrhea. Whew. Diarrhea. Wow. A lot of fluid loss, right? A lot of fluid loss. And then, lastly, the thing that never really occurred to me, but until I was there, was a profound conjunctivitis. If I walked in your house, hey guys, by the way, the clock here is not working, or they never set the clock, so I don't know what my time is. Just for whoever, is managing the clock. Profound red eyes, a conjunctivitis, right? And so those are the things, at least what I saw with Ebola. The differential, of course, is listed there. Always consider hantavirus, especially if it's somebody that's coming from the Navajo nation as well. Abdominal presentations, like I said, there's a lot of GI, issues. Mortality rates are just profound. And if I were to write a board question, I would want you guys to call immediately to state health departments. I would want you guys to call to state health departments as well. Something just advanced, right. And contact, obviously, the CDC. Because there's really no treatment and we're not going to be doing a lot of treatments and you guys would never treat somebody with Ebola, it's highly, highly unlikely. So if I were to write a board, so it's not worth talking about, you know, what was our treatments for Ebola out in Sierra Leone? That was it, right? There was a big brouhaha, I don't know if you guys remember, between the ID doctors, Paul Farmer, with Partners in Health, and Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. It, like, very weirdly spilled out into the New England Journal, the kind of the back and forth that Partners in Health were having with Doctors Without Borders, was whether or not you put an IV in somebody, because there was a risk of Ebola transmission. You know who were the greatest risks to die of Ebola are doctors and nurses. It's no joke, right? So we just used literally bottles of water or rehydration, ORT, oral rehydration therapy. Now, when doctors get to the U.S. or when nurses come back to the U.S., obviously there's a whole treatment protocol that goes into place. It's in Lincoln, Nebraska, and then there's another place in Emory. Yes, Emory. Thank you. Right in Atlanta, of course. Duh. You guys don't need to know about any of that, right? Because that's not where your time is better spent. But where your time is best spent is infection control. And then also contacting and reporting immediately to public health individuals. And this is why I've got those highlighted and bolded, right? So infection control, this is highly, highly transmittable. When I was in Sierra Leone, we were in a no-touch, like, and it's weird, and I'm an ID doctor, so I don't like to touch anything, right? I fist bump, I elbow bump, I don't hug, I don't shake hands, I don't touch anything. So they're like, you know, when I was doing my phone interview, can you, like, be okay not touching? I'm like, me not touching anything? Yeah. Like, with 4 days in, not touching another human being, not in an intimate way. I'm just talking about, like, just not having contact with somebody. It plays with you very, very quickly. That's why you always see Ebola folks will always bump elbows, because that's just the closest to touch. It's very, very transmittable by hands. That's Ebola. So if you suspect, if they give you a question, somebody from West Africa comes in, they've got fever and red eyes, and their LFTs are abnormal, you immediately put them in infection control and you make sure that you are completely PPEs. Let's see, no other hemorrhagic fever virus other than dengue has been acquired in the US. That's something, again, that goes back to dengue. 21 days, where does 21 days come from? 21 days comes from the amount of time that the virus is actually, a person who survives Ebola will host and transmit a Ebola virus for 21 days. So that's most people express it about 3 or 4 days, but 21 days is the maximum amount of time that somebody would potentially transmit Ebola virus. So that's where that magic number 21 comes from. The second magic number is 42. And that's something I'm mentioning now just for you guys to be aware of. 42 is that's when a country is cleared of Ebola, is because that's two cycles of 21 days. That's just something for you guys just to be aware of. So if you guys see it, please, 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 please report to public health authorities, and I would definitely do that on an exam. Those are the various entities in terms of PPEs and barrier face shields, goggles, N95 masks, that sort of stuff. So, again, 21 days is important. And the other thing, too, is this aerosol risk is really not quite known. If I were to bet, I would bet that possibly there is an element of aerosolization, and that was based on some really interesting studies, but clinically we haven't seen it. The only time that Ebola was actually transmitted, there's a, did anybody read The Hot Zone? Great book, right? And in The Hot Zone, they talk about how in Reston, Virginia, there was a, that's where one of the first times we saw Ebola in the U.S., that the monkeys that come in from Africa have to, or primates, are sent to a holding facility to make sure that they don't have any transmittable diseases. These primates had Ebola, so they had to obviously kill them. But a room like 100 feet away, completely separate entrances, there was no interaction whatsoever. But those primates, and they came from a different part, they came from a completely different country, also got Ebola as well. So there is consideration that there was some aerosolization that may have happened, and this is more of an FYI, and this is just me babbling, so I will stop. There's no risk, there's nothing about that on your boards. All right, you have to environment, treat all surfaces, bleach. That's essentially, anytime I smell bleach now, my brain takes me back to Sierra Leone. Cadavers, or this is all stuff that's probably not necessary. Patient care, again, IV fluids, mechanical ventilation, dialysis, that's stuff that you're going to probably not see. Of course, avoid any medications that's going to prompt bleeding. Lassa fever or Rift Valley fever. Finally, ribavirin. Finally, found a disease that may have an effect on. And then, of course, with Ebola, no antivirals exist. What you did hear about in terms of medications like ZMAP are just basically monoclonal antibodies that are basically being delivered to patients. Contacts of patients, it's also very important, but probably not board relatable, but a large part of any Ebola outbreak is you got to find the people because that they were in contact with, because it's so easily transmittable. Hantavirus, I would definitely circle, and I would definitely be aware of, all right, because it is in the United States, all right? So this is a RNA virus. It's in there at the very bottom, you'll see the Hantavirus New World, and it's called Sin Nombre. Sin Nombre means without a name. And this is a really interesting, why was it called Sin Nombre, right? Why did they name a virus with no name? Well, it's because when Hantavirus first appeared, it first appeared on the Navajo Nation, right? Where was it? Castle Rock, I think. Typically the way that these viruses are named is they're named as to where the first location is. Rift Valley fever, right? Lassa, Ebola, because Ebola is a river. So wherever it was first identified is where the name of that pathogen takes on. So they initially called it the Navajo Nation virus. And you can imagine what the Navajo Nation said. They're like, no way are you doing that. So they actually had to go back and rename it, and they renamed it Sin Nombre virus. It causes a pulmonary syndrome. I've seen people die very, very rapidly from this. So you have to have a very, very high index of suspicion. I did, and I sent a 14-year-old girl to Children's Hospital in Phoenix. And unfortunately, when she left my care and she got into the air ambulance, they gave her a dose of Lasix. I told them, do not do that, and they bottomed her out. And so it's not treated like a typical fluid overload. So it's mostly treated with ECMO, right? So, and then the second case I saw, I again identified the patient very, very rapidly, and this time did not send him over to Phoenix, sent her over to University of New Mexico, and she did great. Not to say anything bad about the Phoenix folks, it was the air ambulance. The way that you recognize this previously healthy young adults, the classic story of the first case was that it affected a young runner. He was a Navajo, his name was Begay. This is a standard, this is a typical Navajo name. It's just like Jones or Smith. I forget what his first name was, but Mr. Begay. It was a marathon runner and died very rapidly, and his girlfriend died a couple days later. And that was kind of what raised everybody's attention. I would just be aware of that. You have fever, headaches, cardiopulmonary symptoms developed, and then you'll see some thrombocytopenia as well. In terms of a test, the last thing to consider too is that it usually occurs in cleaning uninhabited trailer cabins or residences. So it's transmitted in it's deer mice, and it's the stool and the urine in deer mice. And so, fortunately for human beings, our flight or fight reaction is to not poop or pee when we get scared, right? Yes, that should be an overwhelming yes, right? Yes, okay, good. Now for deer mice, the flight and fight reaction for deer mice is to poop and pee, right? So they evacuate their bladder and they evacuate their colon, whatever mice colon is. I don't know if that's the right word. But the virus is in there, and the virus lives in the desiccated urine and the desiccated stool upwards to weeks. So when people go into their houses or their garages and they start sweeping up, what they're now doing is aerosolizing virus, and that's how essentially the virus is transmitted. I would know that, I would be aware of it, and I would, again, this is something that we see in the United States. Serology is typical for an IgM, where you'll see rising titers, PCR, and culture. You rarely isolate. All of this stuff ends up going to the CDC anyway. Supportive therapy, and then, of course, prevention includes rodent control, seal holes in home, trap rodents. The Navajo Nation, the Navajos still live in things that are called hogans. You can't see them. If you're driving through the Navajo Nation, you'll never see a hogan, but they're hidden. And they're kind of like traditional mud, kind of these large, elaborate mud kind of homes that the Navajo traditional, especially elderly Navajo people will sleep in. And the floors are oftentimes just the floor of the desert. And so you can see how, and then rodents come and go, and you can see how easy it is. And this is why it affected the Navajo Nation the way it did. In the last 10 minutes or so, let's shift over to fevers of unknown origin. These are getting more and more difficult to kind of diagnose because people aren't in the hospital quite as long as they used to be. I remember people would be in the hospitals for weeks at a time, but hospital stays are obviously being cut short dramatically. But the classic essentially definition is you're going to have your fever illness greater than 3 weeks, negative evaluation. After workup for a week, again, temperature over 38.3, 3 weeks duration without a diagnosis. And here in this case, despite 2 outpatient visits or 3 hospital days. So this is the modern definition of fever of unknown origin. So I'm going to just kind of pick and choose some of these topics that I can kind of comment on that I think would be board relevant. So the categories in terms of what the classical FUOs are was mostly infectious, coming in at about 36%. So 1/3 of them are going to be infectious diseases. Another 1/3 are going to be inflammatory, rheumatological. And then lastly, you're going to see malignancies and some other just things, miscellaneous or non-diagnoses. So in terms of special subsets, nosocomial or postoperative, drug fever, and phlebitis, and pulmonary embolism, and infection related to surgery. I was like, wow, that's really good. And I realized I wrote that. So know all of those, right? So those are all the things that I look for when I'm looking at somebody and evaluating a quote-unquote FUO. Of course, beyond HIV, I'm very specific about HIV and when I use the word AIDS, so I'm specific when I'm using the word AIDS here. That's why I put a T-cell count less than 200. MAC, okay? MAC, all right? So you'll see T-cells less than 50. MAC is an incredibly common cause of death today. Fortunately, we're not seeing people die of HIV anymore. MAC is the only, if I see somebody with MAC now, that the hair on the back of my neck stands up because that is the most common way people are dying of HIV today. Also, I would strongly consider TB. As I mentioned to you before, TB and HIV walk hand in hand, and I would also consider PCP. Jerry brought up a very, very good point about the immune system, and even though we're able to reconstitute an immune system to the pre-HIV infectious immune system, so what we would say back to your normal immune system, people living with HIV still have blood-borne cancers. So lymphomas are very, very common, even if they're well-controlled. Even if they started HIV medicines on the day that HIV was transmitted to them, you still see a little bit more blood-borne cancers, and so that's something that I would strongly consider. Of course, in the elderly, temporal arteritis is something I would strongly consider, as well as malignancy. Again, infectious diseases, TB, endocarditis, Q fever, and all of those would be a function of what the epidemiology of your patient would be. Inflammatory conditions is what I typically see, and I see Still's disease. Look for it, you'll find it, right? You'll see the rash, and then, of course, you'll see the arteritis as well. My first cousin got Kikuchi's disease. So what is Kikuchi's disease? She was like, I think, 20 years old in Canada and in Quebec, and she got all these oral lesions, and her blood work was just, I mean, I thought for sure she had lymphoma. But she had horrible oral lesions, and so it ended up being a disease I'd never heard about called Kikuchi's. And I was just wrapping up medical school when that happened. Of course, malignancies, you're going to want to scan your patients for malignancies. I underline drug fever because I can't tell you how often drug fever is there. Especially, and I hate to say this because beta-lactams are my favorite drugs, right? I mean, I live on beta-lactams, right? But beta-lactams, especially the closer that a beta-lactam is to penicillin in terms of its structural origin, the more likely it is to be cause of a drug fever. So something like Piptazo, something like amoxicillin, so just the beta-lactams by themselves, and I would strongly consider that as well. I am from North Africa. We're Jewish Sephardics. And so in my family, we have a huge amount of familial Mediterranean fever. And so I have familial Mediterranean fever, my brother does, my uncles, a huge part of our family does. I have it separate from the rest of my family, so I'll tell you how my family gets it, and I'll tell you how I get it, so you can now have a concept of what FMF is, right? My family, a lot of my brother and his children and my cousins get an abdominal pain, significant abdominal pain associated with their FMF. For me, it affects me, gives me arthritis. And in fact, when I first got FMF and then all the way through medical school, I would be in crutches in a wheelchair because I could not walk. And I went to medical school in Maine, so it's very difficult to like get crutches with all the snow, right, in Biddeford, Maine, right? But the treatment for it is colchicine. I would definitely know that. Colchicine is the treatment. So if you're ever thinking about FMF, colchicine is it. I had a flare about a year ago. I could not walk at all. All of my lower extremity joints were swollen, red, and I could not walk, and I had to put myself on colchicine, which is terrible because it gives you diarrhea. So just be aware of that. Fictitious fever, I've seen it. Man, I hate to say it. I've seen it. You just got to have an index of suspicion for it, and you got to figure it out and find it as well. But I did kind of underline that fictitious or fraudulent fever exists. Of course, verify your fever in terms of a diagnosis. Those are what the ranges of fevers are. I like to use the ear, and I like to do it myself, the ear thermometer. And the reason why is that it gets as close to the tympanic artery, right? And so that is the closest you can get to a core temperature without having to use a rectal. Let's see what else I can show you there. examine the patient, obviously. Labs are listed there. That's a nice set of opening labs to get started with. And please include an HIV test on there, as well as basically do a scan of the abdomen, chest, and pelvis. In terms of infectious diseases, you'll see abdominal, and in terms of abdominal abscesses, if you see something, you obviously want to drain it. TB or atypical mycobacterium, these are the different ways that you can check for it. If you look for it, you will find it. TB is still so incredibly relevant, and it's something that we still see. I think we're going to start seeing more of it. Culture-negative endocarditis, Jerry talked about a bit. That's something to consider as well. Diagnosis, whenever possible, we always reach for a TEE to make the diagnosis. And then, of course, you may want to consider mononucleosis, and that's a differential of mono there. Again, in terms of granulomatous and collagen vascular diseases, temporal arteritis is another very common. When I look for it, I find it. And treatment with that, obviously, is steroids, as is polymyalgia rheumatica. If you look for it, you'll find it. Steroids, people respond very, very quickly. I've looked for stills. I have found it before. Again, you'll see a rash associated with it, and I've seen it in younger adults, in 20s and 30s. I've seen it a few times. Treatment is with NSAIDs or steroids, and they respond very, very rapidly as well. And there's a couple other illnesses there that you can look at. Tumors, there's a whole list there of various tumors and the quote-unquote omas as well that you should consider. Again, I would look at drug fever, highlight drug fever, and I would just read that section. You could see there that beta-lactams are there. And if I were to write a test question, I would probably do what Jerry said, was either write a question of a drug fever as a result of Bactrim or beta-lactams is what I would essentially do. You should know something called Dress syndrome. I've seen it multiple times, and right off the top of my head right now, I can't. What is it? Can somebody help me? Drug reaction? Severe, yeah. Yeah, I would just be aware of it as well. PEs, look for PEs. There's familiar Mediterranean fever again, and there's the treatment for it is colchicine. Self-induced, again, it's something I've seen. Just have an index of suspicion as well as fictitious as well. So most common diagnosis is in the ID world, it's going to be TB or endocarditis. In the inflammatory world, it's Still's disease. Tumors, you'll find lymphomas and others. There's a granulomatous, hepatitis, drug fevers, FMF, and fictitious. No diagnosis is found upwards in 50%. Prognosis is often very good. And episodic FUOs, explanations only found in a minority, and is often a benign process.